My name is Ian O'Neill, and this is How They Did It, a podcast where we learn filmmaking from those who've gone before us. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to How They Did It, a podcast for indie filmmakers, especially those just starting out looking to make their very first film, although anyone at any level can listen and learn. My guest this week is Paul Dudbridge, the author of Making Your First Blockbuster, Write It, Film It, Blow It Up, which is available now anywhere fine books are sold. He's a director, producer, cinematographer, and educator who makes feature films, television, music videos, and commercials. He's been in the business for over 20 years. He's produced and directed many projects, including The Christmas Storybook, as well as the science fiction series Horizon. Paul guest lectures at various universities and colleges around the UK, and his first book, Shooting Better Movies, The Student Filmmaker's Guide, was released in 2017 and is also available where fine books are sold. Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Dudbridge.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thank you so much for talking to me today.
No worries. I hope you say it's 11 o'clock where you are.
It is 11 a.m. and I'm obviously still waking up. I'm a night hawk. You can tell. Listen, we're going to talk about that great book of yours in a little while. But first, let's get to you. Let's find out a little bit about you. When did you get into the business we call filmmaking?
Well, I've kind of got the classic story, really. My dad bought a video camera for the family to film sports days and holidays and things like that. And my sister and me took it off him one day and we started to make our own little adventure movie. It was kind of like an Indiana Jones thing. It's called Stunt Kids and it featured us, obviously. And it was we found this treasure map to some sort of gold or some rubies or something buried in my friend's back garden. And there was these villains who was my sister and my neighbor, I think, who were kind of after us to try and stop us. And it was a few sword fights and punches and dropping out of trees and all that kind of stuff. And it was great fun. I think my dad, though, he filmed it and he filmed it from the same place, literally. So wherever the action was, he would pan or whatever. But in my head, I was a big fan of Indiana Jones and there was no close-ups. There was, you know, kind of no detail. It was all wide shots. It was a bit of a discipline though, because we had to shoot in order. Literally, Dad would hit the record button. That's when the action would start. And also we had like a stereo off camera playing music. And one of my friends would, like, when the shots stopped, he would press pause. And then when the next shot started, he would unpause it. So the music was a bit choppy. But I just remember when we played it back, sometimes we would hear my neighbor's lawnmower, like, kind of grass. And then it would stop. Then it would start again. And, of course, when you're in the action, you don't notice that going on. It's only when you put it all together. So the whole idea of, like, films, shots, music, sound, all of that sort of started to come about. And we did a film a year for about 10 years.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. It was good fun. Good fun.
Well, that's how you got started in the business. You did a film a year for 10 years?
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking these sort of small, you know, I was 12, then 13, and then we'd go to the joke shop and we'd find these blood capsules and stuff. So we'd put them in the house. So when someone got punched, there would be some blood. And then I got a cap gun for my birthday. So we were running around firing this cap gun and blasting each other. And it was, but as you know, we were like 13-year-olds and we were playing like police detectives and burglars and stuff like that. But for us, it was just, we were on screen. It was awesome.
So when did you transition into sort of the professional side?
Well, each year I would just make something and then we got a new camera. Then I went to, well, my friend went to college when we were about 17, 18, and we started to use sort of tape-to-tape editing where you could be a bit more frame accurate. So that was interesting. We caught the back end of the tape revolution, as it were, which was interesting as well because, you know, you would shoot your rushes and then by the time you'd copy it to the master tape, you're already a generation down. And then to do a copy off that for friends, it would be a second generation. of 8mm video or you know, VHS. We only had two channels of audio. So if you wanted to do dialogue on one, music on another, and then you wanted to put in like a punch sound or a doorbell, that had to be added to the dialogue track.
Oh, wow.
Mixing it down. And I remember one time we did a couple of special effects stuff, some explosions, and in order to shoot slow motion with video, we managed to tweak the jog dial on the video edit mixer. And if you were to record with the jog dial on a little bit on fast forward, it would actually move in slow motion.
So
we record that, but then by the time we would copy that, that would be a second generation by the time we got the slow motion version. Then we'd take that tape out and put it in the playback, copy it across to the master. So by the time you watched the special, you know, your explosion on your copy, it was like fourth generation. So obviously, but, you know, when digital came in, that all changed. But so anyway, yeah, how do we get professional? It was that, kind of went through college. Then I made I did 1 year at college. I didn't go to film school. It was like a small video level thing. And then I made a movie where I cast a girl who worked at a local drama workshop. And she came along, she was early 20s, she came along, was in the movie, and then her boss, who worked at the television studio here in Bristol, he taught a lot of the young actors there, and he came on to the premiere and then said, do you want to come and make movies with us kids, you know, the kids in the group? And I said, yeah, sounds good. And then we had access to Digibeta and higher level broadcast cameras. Mm-hmm. And then when we wanted to make the second or third movie, they didn't want to pay for a cameraman anymore to save money, so they got me trained up on that camera. So
wow,
that was kind of how we got in. But before we did that, obviously I was working with professional cameramen who were then, I still know today, who give me work or whatever. So that was good, all 20 years ago.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So as that's true. You've been in the business for over 20 years now.
Yeah.
Wow. So your first major project was The Christmas Storybook, which was a television drama for a channel in the UK. So yeah. It was ITV, I think?
Yeah, for the local station, yeah.
Yeah, so you produced it, right?
Yeah, and directed it, yeah.
And you directed it. So what were your responsibilities as a producer on the project?
Well, kind of just speaking to the network, as it were, and finding out, you know, what our slot is, what the, you know, where we're going to go. And so it's a Christmas thing, so we had a slot on Christmas Day. But I remember when I pitched it, it was like two short films encompassed in like a storytelling book, a father telling these stories to his kids, kind of bookended. And when I pitched the idea to the head of the network, and this was May time, and he said, the schedule's already done for Christmas. This was like, and I was like, wow, really? And he said, yeah, come and see me January. And I was like, okay. So I put it a note in my diary, January the 2nd. Call Jane. January 2nd came along, picked up the phone and said, can I come in and see you about this thing? He said, yep. And I went out of a meeting and he said, I've got one slot left on Christmas Day. And I was like, I'll take it. So we're talking January the 2nd and he's already got the schedule for the following Christmas done. But that was a nice lesson in how things work, like in the TV and film world. They're just so far ahead. So anyway, we got that gig and then we planned to shoot in the summer and it was great shooting like a Christmas movie in June. Which was, from a producer's point of view, obviously, we're, you know, you haven't got much darkness. Everything's quite bright, or quite late, and we were shooting this thing at night. It was supposed to be snowing. Yeah, so it was good fun, but it was just my main responsibility was obviously getting the shoot and then delivery requirements, cutting the thing down, making sure it's fit for broadcast, quality control, dubbing, all of that kind of stuff. And we had to deliver, yeah, all of delivery stuff, all the contracts. That was my first introduction to that, you know, permissions and contracts and, you know, legalities.
My condolences. Oh, those are horrible.
Yeah. So it was fun. It was a great learning curve. And then it went out on Christmas Day that year.
So can you describe that first day as a director? What was it like being on set for that first time?
I directed stuff before, but what was different about this was the fact that people were definitely going to see it. And someone higher up the network would also see it.
Right.
And it was that kind of sense of, not dread, but kind of like, oh, there's something at stake here. And I remember a story where when I did my first filming job for the BBC here in the UK, I was filming. I spent the whole summer shooting a war movie on this sort of camcorder called a PD-150, which was made by Sony. Great little camera. And I was running around. I knew it inside and out, you know, shooting fast. And then I got my first gig for the BBC, and they put this PD-150 camera in my hand. Now, I should have been, hey, awesome, I know how to shoot this. But psychologically, my brain went, okay, I'm going to be handing this tape over. An editor's going to be watching this. A producer's going to be watching this. It's going to be broadcast. This isn't me making movies anymore. This is, I'm responsible for the footage on this tape. And I kind of froze. I had to tell myself what a white balance button was and how to focus. And after about 10 minutes, I said, look, come on. And I gave myself a bit of a slap and said, you can use this camera. Of course you can. You've been using it for like years. But it was just that psychological barrier that kicked in. And a similar thing happened with the broadcast thing with the studio where, yeah, it was just a sense of someone's going to be watching this and, you know, thousands of people are going to be watching it on TV rather than showing it. Your films that you make to people and friends and family, because back then there wasn't like the internet to, you know, put things on YouTube or Vimeo. So yeah, that was really the difference, really. So the first day was fun and obviously nerve-wracking as well, really. You got to make your day, and are the extras going to turn up? And it's not, well, you know, we can get that shot tomorrow. It might be that, well, there's no more budget for that.
Right.
You got to then tell the exec we ran over or we didn't get the shots or whatever, you know. So that's what it was like.
Yeah, not a fun thing. So what kind of director is Paul Dudbridge?
Well, I'm going to borrow from Clint Eastwood here. Because Clint says he takes the work seriously but not himself. And I thought, I like that. I really like that because I like to kind of get the job done, but, you know, you kind of have a laugh while you're doing it to a certain degree. You know, you don't want to be – if things get go out of whack when the balance – if you're all having a joke and a laugh, the work suffers because you don't get the footage you need. If you're all about the footage and you're stern and curt and it's all about getting that, you know, to make sure you get everything, you know, there's no sort of sense of fun or enjoyment, then you're not fun to be around and you're not going to get the best out of your cast or your crew. So it's about finding that happy medium, really. So, yeah, and I think it's focused. You've got to be focused. I find myself, like anyone I think who writes or makes music or does films, I find myself in that zone sometimes, where you're just 100%, all I'm thinking about is what's the next shot, have we got time, what's the weather doing, when's wrap, when's lunch, is that person late, is that going to cut? And that's a constant thing going through your head for like 12 hours a day.
Ouch.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. So here's because you've been where a lot of people who are listening to this podcast want to be, and that's on set, whether it's behind the camera, you know, operating the camera, whatever it might be. But just how much of a collaboration is filmmaking? Like, the director may be at the helm, but he needs help steering the ship, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the director is nothing without the crew whatsoever. So it's a complete 100% collaboration. I mean, you know, even if you're looking at, from a cinematography point of view, if you're going, look at that lovely shot, and it's like, well, it's only lovely because of the set design as well as the light. And as well as the frame and as well as the performance and as well as the music and everything else. So it's a complete collaboration. And you wouldn't be able to do what you want to do without everyone else. Obviously, from a decision-making point of view, it's not a committee and it is the director's word. But obviously, you need to be able to adopt and allow and accept input from everyone else. And then when the buck stops, you go, right, we're going this way, follow me. Otherwise, if you go too far the other way again, if you open it up to the floor, it's game, you know, everyone jumps in, and then it's a free-for-all then.
And suddenly chaos.
Yeah, and the crew lose confidence in you. And if you go too far the other way again and you don't accept any input, then people are going to stop giving you input eventually, and you're known to not be accepting it. I mean, I've done that. I've worked with directors as a DP before, and you've had that where you kind of know what they want, and your suggestion, obviously non-arrogantly narcissistic kind of way, knows it would work best with the film, it works best with the performance, but the director somehow can't give up what they've been thinking about for the last 3 months, driving in their car last thing at night. They have to see it that way. And obviously, yeah, that's fine, and that's their thing, and that's totally cool. But to allow that, and I say to students when I teach, if you have 10 shots that you need to get and you know how you want them, and the first shot, the DP says, I think you might be able to try it this way, it might be better, and you do that approach, that's fine. And if the second shot you want to do, the actor says, hey, I've always thought, you know, why don't I stand by the window here instead of sitting down? You go, hey, let's do that. Then the third one, the grip says, oh, you could do a little dolly move here. And you go, oh, yes, sir. And you did that for 10 shots. Every single one of those shots is not your shot anymore. But you get the credit for it at the end of the day. And also, you've still decided to go with their idea. So you're still, quote unquote, in control. But you've decided to go with someone else's idea for the better of the movie. And when people watch it, they go, hey, that film was awesome. Great, you know, awesome directing. And you'll go, thank you very much. It's not like when that shot pops up on screen, there's a little cut, a subtitle in the bottom corner going, suggested by the grip. It doesn't work that way. So, you know, you need to be flexible.
Yeah. Because you are, ultimately, it is your decision, isn't it? Because someone they can suggest something to you and you can do it, but in the end, you could say, well, that didn't work. Let's go with my original.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. That's the thing.
Yeah. It's just back to politics. Yeah.
Yeah. So have you ever been part of finding funding for a film?
Yes. In fact, I'm right in the middle of that right now.
Oh, perfect. Oh, please. Please tell us what that experience is like for you.
Challenging. and it's all emotions all riled up into one. One day you're up, one day you're down. Then you have something which is looking promising, then that falls apart. Then this thing over here happens that looks promising. Then it looks even more promising, then that falls apart. And it's like, it's just that roller coaster.
Is this private funding, or are you going through production companies?
No, it's private funding, yeah.
Oh. Yeah, so that's exactly what I'm going to be doing. So, I'm really looking forward to it. He says sarcastically.
It's one of those things where, you know, you have to keep your emotions in check and just go, right. Yeah, we'll see what happens. I always remember, I was saying to someone the other day, there's a fable, I'm going to get it wrong, but there's a fable I think about an old man and his son one time about how he's got two horses and one of the horses bolts. And he says, hey, you know, father, I think we've lost a horse. And the father says, perhaps. And then 2 days later, the horse comes back with two other horses. So they've got three horses. He says, oh, my God. Father, we've got three horses now. Isn't that wonderful? And he says, perhaps. And then the story moves on, and basically then the boy ends up breaking his leg, and then the government turn up and say, and he says, oh, father, I broke my leg. Is that terrible? And he says, yeah, perhaps. And then, like, the next day the government turn up and say, we're going to war. We need a horse and every able-bodied boy to fight. And it turns out, well, they're not going to lose any horses because they got two extra the day before. And his son now can't go to war because of his broken leg. Huh. And it's just one of these things where when it's bad, it's not necessarily bad. And when it's really good, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to stay that way. Or it could be. I don't know. And I kind of keep that little story in the back of my head sometimes. When it's bad, it's not necessarily the end of the run. And when it's good, it doesn't mean that that's locked in place.
Yeah.
So it's a tough road. And I was watching the making of Open Range, which is a Kevin Costner Western from about 2003. And I really love that movie. But on the DVD, there's a behind the scenes for about an hour and a half, which is really Costner just sort of opens up his heart and says, I couldn't get the funding for this. We were doing a recce and I'm chartering the helicopter on my credit card because the funding isn't in place. We're looking at locations and I still haven't got the production budget. And then we were talking to an investor. And he was always talking, but he would never quite give up the money. And he was dragging them along. And he realized that this investor guy was just messing them around, getting off on just going to parties, talking, oh, yeah, I was on the phone to Robert Duvall, I was on the phone to Costner, I'm involved in his new movie. And in the end, I think Costner calls him some slippery dick. And eventually he had to come to the UK and they got some production company to put some funding in. But if Costner has issues with funding and it's ups and downs, then, you know, we're allowed to do it as well.
So oh, absolutely.
Give yourself a pass if it doesn't quite work.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you started out funding, can I be so bold as to ask, like, did you make a list of people that you were going to talk to? Did you have sort of an inner ring, outer ring kind of mentality?
The project that we're working on came to me through a couple of execs that happened to know some investors. And we're kind of, you know, it was, you know, kind of putting the package together to say what we can do. And then you're working through the government here about tax rebates and tax relief, all that kind of business. So you're talking to the HMRC and you're talking to the investors. And then there's investor groups as well that kind of have a big pot of money, but they want to put the budget in together. But then they take 50% of whatever they make and all that. So you're trying to negotiate these deals it's kind of a fairly new experience to me as well. So I'm not, you know, ultra experienced of it, but it's challenging. It's challenging.
Wow. Good luck with that.
What's that?
I was going to say good luck with that.
Thank you. Yeah.
Because I know it's not an easy thing to do. It really isn't. So good luck. Now, you know what? Let's shift gears.
Sure.
Let's talk about this awesome book, Making Your First Blockbuster. Write it, film it, blow it up. And before I ask you any questions about it, I just have to say that this book was a very pleasant surprise for me, because anything that has blockbuster in it kind of skews me to that, let's make something ordinary bigger, louder, flashier. But this book isn't that at all. It's a well laid out course in filmmaking. It's full of incredibly useful information for any filmmaker. So congratulations on that accomplishment.
Thank you, Ian. That's very kind. Thank you for your words.
No, seriously, I mean every word of it. So why did you write this book? Why this book?
Okay. I think I say this is the opening line of the introduction is I wanted to write the book I wish I had when I was 18. And that pretty much sums it up, because when I was 18, I'm trying to blow out fireball explosions, running around with blank foreign pistols and setting off squibs and firecrackers and all that kind of stuff. And for filming action fights, I was looking at fights, you know, I'm studying fight films, you know, films with action bits in them, and I'm trying to copy it. And then when we get to the edit, it doesn't quite work. Why doesn't that work? And there's more to it than this. And I don't know. It just didn't quite come together. And I almost, you know, that's where, you know, I've got experience now of doing that. So I know how to shoot fights, how to make the cut, and then doing squibs and bullet hits and blank firing guns and all that kind of stuff. And I kind of, all my early movies when I was 18, you know, they're crap, basically. They don't, you know, they're fun to watch and reflect on. But, you know, when you're watching it, when I was making it, sorry, you kind of think that you are emulating those big blockbusters, but actually you're not. It's not framed correctly. It's too fast or too slow, or it's all close up and it should be mediums or whatever. So that's you know, how I came about, really. And a lot of the material was kind of, I had to cut from my first book, because the first book, Shooting Better Movies, was a sort of pretty much an epic beast. And then when I got the contract with Michael Vesey, who are an awesome publisher, but they just said, you know, we need 35,000 words for this first book, and I just had to chop so much out, like whole chapters, which was quite gutting at the time. And then when I was thinking about doing this action, you know, this blockbuster book and on action, I thought, well, hang on, I've got all these chapters that have been the first book, you know, let's put all that in. So that's where it came about, really. And obviously, blockbuster, it's a bit of a two-way title, where making your blockbuster is whatever your film is. Blockbuster obviously refers to the fact that a lot of the examples I'm giving are from James Bond and, you know, X-Men or whatever. It's sort of action cinema, contemporary cinema. So it's quite relevant to the people reading it. But it also, you know, it could be your £2 million horror film you're about to make, or your £1,000 drama in your mum's front room, or whatever it might be. It's still your blockbuster. Yeah. So that's where the title came from.
Well, and one thing I have to thank you for is chapter one, writing your blockbuster. I love how in-depth you are about the writing process. And the reason I say that is a lot of new filmmakers, they don't put enough into the writing process. They try to get to the thing they love the most, which is getting to the camera, getting the action, shooting it. But it suffers because they haven't put enough into the writing process. You really take them step by step through the writing process. Thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah. Oh, it's brilliant.
Sure. It's lovely. Thank you.
No worries. So can you give me an example? And this is one of the things that appears in the book. And I thought it was brilliant, by the way, because not a lot of people think about this. But can you give me an example of how the hero must be in the know?
Sure. Well, the hero being in the know means that the hero knows more really than what we do. And that makes them smart. And they need to be smart because we need them to lead us through the film that we're about to see. And even if they don't know the information, there's a confidence to them that they will find out what needs to be known. So there are a couple of the examples I give in the book, I think. One is there's a scene from the opening of Angels and Demons where Tom Hanks is swimming in a pool, literally the opening of the movie. And as he's swimming, he comes up for air and looks to the left, and he sees a man in a suit with a satchel walking along the side of the pool. And then he looks up for air again as he does his breaststroke. And then he sees like this cross key emblem on the bag. And then by the time he gets to the end of the pool and the man stops and Hanks comes up to greet him, I think Hanks says something like, you know, a swim will do you good. It can help your jet lag. Rather than, who are you? I'm swimming here. What do you want?
Type thing.
Which means Hanks is then basically asking the question, who is he? Because the audience are thinking, who is this guy? So for Hanks to say, who are you, would put Hanks on the same level as us.
That's right.
We don't want. We want to have Hanks be a bit knowledgeable. And basically, he's looked at the cross key emblem and he knows that he's from the Vatican. He knows he's just got off a plane, so therefore he's 5 hours behind, the jet lag, etc., whatever it might be.
Yeah.
So that's puts Hanks up on a different level to us. And I think the other example I give is from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where Harrison Ford's being told the story of the knights of the Crusades about how they left these stone tablets, like, you know, to guide anyone to the Holy Grail and stuff. And it's about halfway through where the other character, Julian Glover, who's the actor in the scene, is talking to Harrison Ford. Indiana Jones actually stops him and says, I know the rest of this story. And he proceeds to then tell the rest of the story. So it puts Harrison's or Indiana Jones on a level where he knows the information. He's not just sat there listening to someone else. And then you see it all the time. James Bond does it. You know, M will say to Bond, what do you know about supervillain, you know, Blofeld? And he'll say, well, he's this maniac. He's been around for how many years? He's got interest in these oil companies. And he knows the information. So that's what the hero in the know is about.
It really does set up our confidence in the hero, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We believe them. We want to be with them now. We want to learn from them. It's just, it's such a small thing. It's a small detail, but it's so huge.
Yeah.
And it really is.
It's interesting. I didn't put it in the book because it was quite negative, but there's a movie that came out a couple of years ago called The Mummy with Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
I've never seen this happen before on a film of that scale. And I'm a really big Tom Cruise fan. I love his work. And I think the work that he does, and he's always quite in control of this, but he spends the entire film, including up until the finale, basically going, what's going on? He literally says, what's going on? I don't know what's happening. Someone please tell me what's happening. And the building's falling down around him. And it's like, the crews of the Mission Impossible movies would be going, right, come follow me. This is the way out.
Yeah.
In this film, he's just this kind of weak, lacking in confidence, always asking questions about what's happening. And it's a real surprise when that you know, happened. And I there's growing up, there's a book that I was my Bible, which was William Goldman's Adventures in the Screen Trade.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome, awesome book. And he would talk about protecting the star quite a lot. And that's something that carries through the scripts that I read now, the scripts that I write. And there was a scene in the beginning of The Mummy where they uncover, Tom Cruise and his sidekick uncover the tomb of the mummy that's been buried. And yeah. there's a rope, I think, that unleashes the latch that lets the mummy out. And Cruise is the one that carelessly cuts it. And it's interesting because from a screenwriter's point of view, you have a sidekick who you've already established to be fairly silly and incompetent. And the sidekick should have been the one that cuts the rope. And then Cruise has to be the one that, to put the mummy back in its case later in the film. But all the way through the movie, you're going, well, Cruise, you were the one that let it out. So therefore, you know, we've got no sympathy for you. And it was a real mystery as to why they would. And in any other movie, that's what would happen.
You know, it's funny because even when you look at the box office, I think it proves that that kind of was a downfall for this film.
Yeah. I mean, you know? That's the other thing as well, because I call it the mum factor, where my mum won't go, oh, Cruise, you know, should have, you know, they should have protected the star more. Cruise was asking too many questions. She'd just go, yeah, it wasn't very good, was it?
Yeah.
And that's all she'll know, is because she wasn't wrapped up. But she won't be able to articulate it, which 90% of cinema audiences can't do. It's only some people that are in the know that understand why something doesn't work. So it's interesting that, you know, it didn't do very well, you know, at the box office.
Yeah. Well, you know what? And that's just an example of one thing from that particular chapter. So there's a lot of information in there. So then you go on to a chapter on producing your blockbuster, and it gives a great breakdown of what's involved. Can you just touch on the part about why a blockbuster doesn't have to be expensive?
Sure. Well, it's a couple of things. I think this is also in the directing chapter, but I'm going to talk about it now, something is about how something can be filmed. So what makes something look expensive can be the production value. It's the size of the frame. It's getting the set that you paid for, or your brilliant location on screen to give it that production value. And I think I say in the book that you could get the same kit, the same location, and give it to a group A, and they will produce a certain image, a certain sequence, and then you give it to some professionals that understand depth and orientation and framing, and they could make exactly the same scene but better with the same kit at the same location. So it's not toys. It's not about rain shots and extras and special effects. It's about how you film something. Orientation, wide shots. I just come off a project recently where I wasn't directing it, but I didn't feel that we utilized the location. You know, 100% of the time, if you have a location that costs a lot of money, point the camera at it. Yeah. So that's one of those things where you kind of go, okay, that's how you can make it look expensive. The other thing is you can reuse sets. You know, if you've built a set and it's a certain, you know, there's a certain wallpaper or chairs or window, rather than build another set, could you, get your crew to give it a lick of paint, put some white dust sheets over it, and suddenly it's a different area, different house, point the camera a different direction, change the lighting. Someone walks around with a torch now rather than it being full daylight, and the audience don't know it's the same set that was, seen two or three scenes earlier. And I picked that up actually from doing my own work, but also through Ridley Scott. Now, Ridley Scott, I'm a big fan of his work, and a lot of his sort of the breakdowns he gives on his DVDs, where he would say that with Gladiator and a couple of his historical epics, he would have the same set, move a few columns around, drape some stuff, and change the lighting, and suddenly it becomes the emperor's bedroom instead of the throne room, instead of the courtroom. Mm-hmm. And he said you can just milk the set. I think another thing about how it doesn't need to be expensive is using or sort of teaching yourself things like visual effects and what you can do in camera and with After Effects and how you can do stuff. So you end up with, you could have some cool explosions or cool muzzle flashes or from the sort of that spectacle stuff, or it could even be how you can change the sky. I've done a couple of things recently where we lost the sky, we lost the sun, and the sky went quite white. Instead of nice blue clouds with, you know, blue skies, perfect clouds. So now my effects guy just went in and changed the sky, put the sky back in. So you can make it quite visually. You can make, instead of being quite flat and bland, now you've got this gorgeous sunset that gives you that production value. So it's about teaching yourself those tools. Get a copy of After Effects. Get some books. Run a course online, or you know, how to teach yourself that kind of stuff. You don't need to be an expert, but just enough to go, do you know what? I can paint that out. I can change the sky. I can add an explosion to give your movie some production value.
Wow. Yeah, it's like being in the one house and using every room.
Yeah.
You know, or using the same room just from a different angle.
Absolutely.
And suddenly you're in a different room.
Yep.
You know, yep. So yeah, that's how you can keep the cost down. Oh, you're giving us some great information here. Keep going. This is awesome.
I'll add to this quickly. Let's add to this. Reducing traveling is another thing.
So yes.
So if you can reuse the same rooms, you're not then traveling halfway across town to another office set or someone else's garage or something. You're saying, hey, let's just point the camera that way, film in their basement, put some things there, and suddenly there's your office. So we're shooting there for 3 hours instead of one because we're spending 2 hours traveling.
Yeah, and breaking down. I mean, breaking down a set and building it up again is just crazy. So, yeah, that saves a lot of time and money.
Yeah.
Very good. So you have chapters on casting and filming, and then comes my favorite, directing. Are there differences when directing between, say, a drama and a blockbuster?
No, I think
it's... Or are they one and the same?
I think they're one and the same. The acting still needs to be believable.
Right.
You know, if you're crying over the fact that, you know, a relative just died in that drama, or you're crying over the fact that, you know... San Andreas Fault just split open and you lost your house and your dog, you still need to play believable that that's happened.
Right.
One's not going to be more over the top than the other or whatever from a performance point of view. So I would say no, I don't think there is. It's just about the believability, whichever is reflecting the scene at hand.
Yeah. Beautiful. So you take a hard look at stunts and special effects and visual effects. What do you think is a first concern for a filmmaker when dealing with practical effects?
Okay. For practical effects, the first thing is probably safety.
Yeah.
I've seen it before where, you know, you've got actors running around blasting their blank firing guns, shells are coming out, you've got debris and all that kind of stuff. Any type of practical effect, you know, rain or something like that, obviously you're looking at electrics with water, fireballs and explosions, fire, gas, you know, all of that stuff. That's all has the potential, you know, to be dangerous, which is why you obviously hire a special technician.
Yeah.
But accidents happen, you know. It's just one of those things, it's just safety. And obviously the other things are cost. It might be the fact that if it's practical, it might be one take, especially if you're blowing something up or damaging a car or bullets in a wall or something like that. Mm-hmm. So you need to make sure that, you know, stuff like the shot is wide enough or it's in focus and all that kind of stuff. I mean, in my early days, I realized that, you know, now you can obviously crop the image without any loss in resolution. But back then I couldn't do it. And they're kind of like the explosion looks tiny in my wide angle and it's sometimes, you know, you can go the other way where directors think that in order to make it look amazing, you could zoom in. So the explosion might fill the frame, but then the explosion is only as big as the frame. Then anything outside of that frame is lost money really. So with any kind of special effect, it's always good to go wider.
Yeah.
To make sure you capture it, and then you can always reframe nowadays anyway.
Yeah.
And just be mindful if it is just one take. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, it's very difficult to get that. You got to get it right.
Yeah.
So, would you take one over the other? Special effects as practical or digital?
It depends.
Which one would you prefer?
Do you know what? It depends on what you're doing. I must admit, I am a big fan of visual effects. I do like stuff in camera, but then I like the control of doing it in post.
Right.
And also from a cost point of view, you know, with pre-keyed explosion fireballs now that you can download from places like Action VFX and things like that, you can get an explosion which is filmed live in 4K and it's pre-keyed. Now, you can stick that explosion in your film now. Now, to get that practically, you're also then looking at, oh, if what if you don't expose it correctly and it just wipes out the middle, each explosion costs you $300 or £300. The special effects guy is only there for one day. You know, it could cost a lot, but with actually, you know, you can download that explosion for $20.
Wow.
You know, and you can make it as big or as small as you want, flip it around, crop it, then you've got two explosions, you know? So that's where it's going now, which is where I harken back to, like, how to make a film, like, not as expensive as it could be. That's a good example there. There's a lot of talk now. There's a lot of backlash about how things need to be practical and in camera, and computer-generated stuff is taking over. And it's like, even stuff that people think are done practical now, there's still a heavy visual effects component to it. And VFX now is so good and so accessible, it's actually swung a little bit the other way, where it's actually better for filmmakers from a safety point of view, from a cost point of view, from a control point of view. But obviously, there's an adrenaline rush with the practical stuff. I mean, rain, I wouldn't want to do VFX necessarily. It would be one of those things where it'd be practical for stuff like rain and fog. And then if anything happened where there was a pickup day, we couldn't get the effects guy, or it was just a retake on the close-up, then I could use VFX rain to make that work. But I wouldn't, you know, as soon as you have rain hitting people's heads and off the back of the car or the roof of the car, you can't really animate that realistically. Mm-hmm. So it would be a VFX would help you out of the shit there rather than be the first way to go.
Right. No, that it makes perfect sense. And then there's that insurance cost as well.
So, oh, absolutely.
You know, you take that into account as well. So if you're doing it on your computer, you don't have to insure people from your computer. Something to consider, folks.
Yes.
So you have a great section on editing, and I wanted to get your take on cutting on action. Why does an editor have to know about that?
Well, cutting on action is obviously when you're cutting from something like a wide shot to a close-up and you're trying to find that cut just on the movement of the action. So as someone steps up or stands up from a chair, closes a door, takes a sip of coffee, something like that. And cutting on action is – it basically gives the impression that it's happening for real, it's happening live, and that it's not planned, even though it's two shots cut together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like I do some experiments sometimes when I'm teaching some students, and I would say, like, if I was sat in a chair and you were on a close-up on me, and then the camera dropped back to a wide shot to capture me standing up, in the audience's minds, subconsciously, they would know that the camera knew what I was about to do because they've adapted to it. They've right. come back to the wide shot to allow for that person to stand up. How did we know that they were going to stand up? Therefore, it's not real. So it kind of puts it into that subconscious mind that actually what you're watching is real. And I use the analogy of maybe like one of those live TV shows where you have a galley where there's a director in the galley room going, okay, cut to camera six. Oh my God, the guy's just walked out the door. Cut to camera two. Da-da-da-da. And it's kind of they're trying to play catch up with the action. And that's the kind of thing you're trying to get across when you cut your drama. You're trying to make it cut fluidly.
Mm-hmm.
So
you know what, the book is so deep into filmmaking that you even have a chapter on music for your blockbuster. How important is that?
Oh, music is essential. You know, it's that's where half of the emotion comes from, that's where half the excitement comes from. And yeah, I think I'm a big fan of, like, I love when you're cutting something and then you drop a temp score on, or you drop the score that composers put together, and the whole thing just lifts. It can sort of patch over little issues in the edit. It can save a scene. It can make a scene that you feel slow a little bit faster, which is why I think in the book I'm a big advocate of actually cutting to it. Well, at a certain point, you add a temp score and you cut to the temp score, because you don't want to start cutting at the material thinking it needs to be quicker, when actually the music element's going to do that for you, and you might actually start taking away good material to make this thing fast, when actually the music's going to give it that little extra lift in the last, you know, mile, as it were. So music is amazing. And I think I think I'll use the example of Heat, where the or there are in the big famous robbery scene halfway through the movie, there's this kind of ticking clock tension, you know, this music's building up, and then the second the first gunshot goes off within the streets, the music stops and you're into just sound effects that adds to the realism. And the opposite of that is when Tom Hanks in Castaway, which I thought was just phenomenal, where you have a movie and for an hour and a half there is zero score, nothing over the titles, you know, and it's only when Hanks finally gets on the raft and escapes the island and looks back, the score comes in, and that's the emotional weight. And you just, you know, like Zemeckis was saying on the commentary, I think he was saying, you know, there's no score, because a score would be a comfort to Hanks as he's looking at the picture of his wife. It would be like, oh, I feel sad for him now. It's a comfort here, there's sounds, but actually having no music, he can't hear music, so why should we, type thing. And I thought that was really good. So there's a lot of power to be had.
Yeah, there is. There really is. Yeah. When I read about it and now that I think about it, it's just, it can change how somebody perceives a scene.
Yeah.
Just by the music alone. So for somebody who's making that $1,000 or £1,000 blockbuster in your auntie's backyard, where do they get the music? Because this is hard.
Yeah. Well, now online, there's a lot of royalty-free music that you can download. And I think if you just credit them, you can say, hey, look, music by so-and-so, and you know.
Yeah.
I think you can do that now, which is quite good. I got a couple of bits from about 5 or 6 years ago. There's a website called Video Copilot who used to do the pre-keyed action bullet hits and special effects. They don't do it so much anymore. But when you bought their package, there was a big music folder on there where they basically scored various pieces of music, and they'd called it like a name from a film that you knew. So it'd be sort of like The Marshes, and it would be like it's very similar to The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings, or it would be, you know, kind of Trontastic, and it would be like Tron. It would be all like electronic music. And you could use that music in your film rather than trying to find someone to compose music for you.
Yeah, so there's music out there to be had. You just have to look for the royalty-free stuff. There's lots of sites out there that you can download, guys. So make sure you check that out. So as a final word on your book, who should buy it? Who is this book for?
Well, I would like to say anyone that's interested in genre filmmaking, really. It's not obviously experimental. If you're looking at experimental films and things like that, this is very Hollywood-based, contemporary. If you're looking to do any type of genre movie, your horror, your action, you know, even your drama stuff, because obviously everything's still relatable. But I would say as well, the first book was obviously aimed at students, where it was like, what's an f-stop? What's a wide shot? Why is that good? This is more sort of intermediate professional, where I skip right past all that stuff and go, right, your backlights, you know, this, and you know, make sure that you have, you know, CTO gel on this light or whatever it might be. So rather than explaining what that is, I'm assuming that you know most of it.
Right.
And I, you know, I'd say I don't talk too much about like layout in the writing chapter and all that kind of stuff, because if you're writing, it's almost like you've been writing for a few years anyway. Now you just want to add that extra spark, or maybe why is the reason your script isn't quite working? Maybe there's something in the book that can help answer that question. Because if I did all the introduction stuff as well, it'd be twice as long.
Oh, it would be huge. Yet you still go in depth. You really do give a lot of great information. So, I mean, if you're just starting out, I think it's something you can add to your collection of books to read. I really do, because you do go pretty in depth in all of the aspects of filmmaking. So, for my opinion, pick up his book. I don't care what you are, intermediate, beginner, whatever. Just pick the book up. You'll love it. Okay, so we're down to what I call the big three, the final three questions I ask every guest on the show. What is the biggest filmmaking mistake you ever made, and how did you overcome it?
Well, it's actually related to my Christmas movie that we talked about for the IT network. Basically, I didn't have a script supervisor timing thing. So what the hard lesson I learned, we filmed the movie, the one of the Christmas short films that we're doing as part of this show, and the slot that you have on TV has to be, it's exact, it's frame accurate. So, you know, before the ad break, it's 11 minutes. And then there's a 3-second hold for the title before the commercials. Then there's another 3-second hold as we come back from commercials. Then another 11-minute break. That's not 11 minutes in one frame. That's 11 minutes exactly. Mm-hmm. We were cutting the second movie, and we were like a minute and a half over. So you start trimming bits here, trimming bits there. And then we realized in order to make the time slot, I actually had to chop part of a shot and a sequence that was the end reveal. So basically, it kind of in the film itself, there's this mystery old man that comes out of the snow who's like an angel kind of to help this young woman get over her loss. And he basically at the end, he says, you know, he basically says, you know, not who he is, but we kind of work out who he is. And then he walks away from the village hall. But we had to trim it so much that we didn't have that. And he now plays like she dreamt it, which has been done before. It's cliche. And I hated it. It's because we had to hack off. Literally, if I had another 30 seconds, I could have told the story that I wanted and told the story that was written. But we had to change the ending to fit the broadcast slot. So when you say, how did you overcome it? I still haven't overcome it. It keeps me awake at night.
Oh, so, man. Timing is everything.
Yeah. And just look at not only that, but just look at your page count as well, because I've done that before previously where I had like a 19-page script and it had to cut down to like 15-minute slot for a festival. And you realize you kind of go, I'll be fine. But actually, that's 4 minutes. Mm-hmm. And you kind of go, in your head, you're like, no, it'd be fine when you cut it. And it's like, just understanding that, you know, 19 pages is probably 19 minutes thereabout. And also just what a script, you know, a one line, an eighth of a page where it says, Sarah walks around the empty halls of the mansion house. That could be 4 shots. It's an eighth of a page, but actually each one of those shots is 20 seconds. So you're now looking at like, or 30 seconds, you're now looking at 2 minutes of screen time for an eighth of a page. Now, when you add the rest of the information on that script page, you're now into 4 minutes, maybe 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Which you kind of go, and also from a production standpoint, that's obviously a lot to shoot. So that was my biggest mistake.
Oh, man. Well, what is the best filmmaking advice you ever received?
Ever received was interesting. Well, it wasn't advice directly, but it was what someone did. I was on a commercial, directing a commercial a long time ago, and you get caught up in the rush of things. And it was a family in a car driving down to this holiday park. And I had a grip on set who was quite an experienced grip, who's a friend of mine. And I wanted a shot outside the window looking at other houses that they were driving into. And time was getting, and I fell into that trap of rushing and kind of going, oh, no, there's no time for that, no time for that. We'll have to move on. And this grip kind of gently, not in front of everyone, he took me to a side subtly and put his hand on my arm and just said, stop.
Oh, yeah.
Do you need that shot? And I went, yeah. And he said, well, let's get it.
Oh, wow. And I went,
okay. And we turned the camera around and I got the shot. But he was just able just to recognize that I was a little bit flustered and I was about to drop something that I didn't need to drop. And I've seen it on set so many times where you rush through things and they go, oh, I've got time. And then at the end of the day, we hang around for 15 minutes chatting. And it's like, well, we could have been getting those shots that we dropped because we're now hanging around at the end of the day, you know.
Yeah.
So that was the best advice that someone got. Just remember that now, just to go, stop. Is that a completely essential? Yes, it is. Well, let's get it.
Yeah. Wow, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Name a film that inspired you.
Well, I talk about it in the introduction of the book. It's probably Raiders of the Lost Ark. Well, there's a few. This is a really awkward, difficult question. There's Raiders. Raiders is what I first saw, and I started to realize, you know, what's real and what's not. Back to the Future was an interesting one because it inspired me because I used to watch the end scene when Marty was driving towards the clock tower. After I'd seen it like 1,000 times as a kid, and my adrenaline, my heart would still be racing. And I questioned it one day when I said, why is my heart racing when I know the outcome? And it was because I'd still get the power of the movie. I'd been swept up again, and I was questioning whether he's actually going to do it this time. And so that was really bizarre. And then Last Crusade, Indiana Jones, was a turning point for me because I started to realize how things are put together. And I remember reading the making of, and it would say how Harrison Ford stepped off a boat in Venice, walked through to the church, and the church is in Pinewood Studios in London, 400 miles away. And I'd be like, that can't be true because his costume and his hair would have to be exactly the same. So mm-hmm. How have they filmed it? Why didn't they film it in Venice? Why London? And then you realize that films are put together out of order, studio location, the hair has to match continuity. And I started to kind of work that out. And I used to look at the photo of Harrison Ford on the front of it, this photo. And I used to be like mesmerized by it. And I didn't know why. And then looking back, when I became a DP, it was the fact that he had this amber golden backlight. It was diffused. There was some diffusion. Mm-hmm. You know, he was softly keyed from one side. You saw the stubble on the spill side of his face. And that's what made up the image. And I was just like, oh, he's lit like that. That's why I like it. Now when I shoot stuff, there's all this amber backlight. Because I'm copying Doug Slocum, who shot Last Crusade. So, yeah, that would probably be what.
Oh, that's brilliant, man. That is absolutely brilliant. Well, listen, I'm going to put a link to your book in the show notes for sure. But just to remind people, it's easy to find on Amazon. Just look up Making Your First Blockbuster or look up Paul Dudbridge. You'll find it. And I hope you'll pick it up because it's a really great book. So to finish this off, what's next for you? Where can people find out about what you're up to?
Well, my website is pauldudbridge.com. On Twitter, I'm at Hanover Pictures, so you can find me there. And obviously on my website, there's links to Instagram and things like that. I mean, my next two projects, I've got two features. One we're going to make in the summer, which is a reimagining of The Invisible Man. It's a period action-adventure movie, and we've had a wonderful script written by an American writer called Philip Day. And he's written this great script, and I can't wait to make it. There's lots of visual effects, lots of action, filming it here in Bristol. And then I have another script that I've kind of set in development. I'm literally due to get the script tomorrow morning. it's a Western. I thought of this story. I'm sort of in prep for Invisible Man, so I can't write it myself. And Jim, who's writing it, Jim Griffin, he's a great writer, so I've sort of asked him if he wanted to do it. And I'm really excited about that. It's a Western where the basic story is there's a British woman who is over in the Wild West, and she asks this cowboy to come and help her because her sister has been kidnapped by a posse. Ooh. And the posse are holed up in a town which is haunted. So... he's got to get there, rescue this, you know, help this woman rescue his sister. You know, what are the gang like? But there's this town that's been abandoned because it's haunted. So we're pitching it as Butch Cassidy meets Raiders meets Ghostbusters.
And it's called?
It's called Who Fortune Favors.
Wow.
Yeah, because the idea is the premise is at the end of Main Street of this haunted town, there's a bank full of gold. So all the cowboys try and get the gold if the legend's true, but obviously they don't get that far because the goat take care of them. So I can't wait to read it. It was, like I say, Jim and I worked on the story, but he's written the script, fleshed out the characters. So I can't wait to read it. So, you know, early tomorrow morning, hopefully.
Well, you know what, Paul? Thank you so much for being here. I cannot thank you enough. This was fantastic. My listeners are going to learn a great deal from you, and they should pick up the book to learn more.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Another show down and more to come in the weeks ahead. Thanks so much for listening. As always, if you have any comments or questions about the show, please stop by my Facebook page at How They Did It Podcast. I'm on Twitter at HFilmmaking and on Instagram at How They Did It Filmmaking. Please show your support for the show by subscribing on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Thanks again for joining me, and I'll be back with another show next week. Until then, keep shooting.